This is EAA Radio, broadcasting the spirit of aviation around the globe.
I'm Farid Guillot. The aviation bug bites at a young age. For EAA member Peter Berger, it bit when he was only 6 years old. Aviation ran in his family, and his first brush with flight was when his uncle worked as a Luscombe salesman. His father was also an avid flyer, and Peter would soon follow suit, using the first money he earned after graduate school on flying lessons.
Well, I started in aviation in 1938 when I was 6 years old. I had an uncle who was a Luscombe salesman, and he'd show up with a brand new airplane and put enough pillows in the right seat for me to see out, and we'd go out and do loops and spins until he thought the airplane was okay to deliver to a customer. And I actually got to manipulate the controls as a six-year-old, but it wasn't until I had earned my first $500 out of graduate school that I was able to afford flying lessons, and I've been flying ever since.
And how did you become involved in the EAA?
Well, it was sort of a natural migration. I started out as a student pilot and then joined another organization and met some folks from EAA and buddied up with them. I'd always had a hankering to build my own aircraft, and I've owned almost 30 different aircraft, commercially built ones. When I started receiving EAA publications back when Paul was still president, I joined as a life member. That was a long, long time ago. My number is 109613, which indicates about the time that I first joined. And I've been studying EAA ever since. And I built a Aventura with the help of the members of Chapter 56 in Fowlerville, Michigan. Flew that to Florida. I also built an ultralight, and I was the first person to file for and obtain the records for flight across the country. Actually, I wasn't the first person to fly across the country, but I was the first person to obtain records. I have 56 U.S. and world national records that I obtained on that flight.
Let's talk a little bit about that. In 1981, you made a very long trip, but a very fast one in a Quicksilver MX-1,
yeah,
which you donated to the museum a couple years later.
Yep.
Looking back at that, when people ask you about that topic, what do you think about that flight?
Well, I noticed that as ultralights were getting started, the people who were involved were advanced guard, you might say, like surfers and mountain climbers and so on, people who were far out, and they did not know there was a system for aviation records since 1783. And I thought here was an opportunity that just leaped out at me to set some records. And it turned out that as a result of events following the flight, I'll hold those records in perpetuity. And the record book simply says Mr. Berger holds most of the records. The FAI disputed the records every which way they could, because the French at the time were not setting many records, and they wanted... the FAI headquartered in Europe wanted to favor the French pilots. And those fights led to the cancellation of the ultralight category and replacement by the microlight category. So the ultralight category no longer can set records.
So you're pretty protected as far as that record goes, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Those 56 records are good. Subsequently, I flew my twin Comanche from Fort Myers to New Orleans and back, and set a few records there, so I hold a total of 60.
Why don't you tell us about the chapters that you're involved with in Michigan? You said you're members of three different ones.
Well, there aren't three chapters in Michigan that I'm involved with. The first chapter I was involved with in Michigan is in Fowlerville. It is a chapter that includes some builders and some pilots. The other next chapter I'm involved with is 202 in Sandy Creek, Panama City, Florida. That is a chapter that consists mostly of older gentlemen who reminisce about things. And one of the troubles that that chapter has, it's had a number of fatalities because of lack of procedure and follow-through. And the other chapter that I'm involved with just recently is an extremely well-run chapter in Gaylord, Michigan, 1095. And it's most impressive, the difference between 1095 and the other chapters of which I'm aware. And I had a lot of chapter exposure after the ultralight flight. I gave my talk showing the photographs of the flight 144 times, and about half of that was the EAA chapters. And I found there were enormous differences in the way chapters are put together and run, the kind of people that are involved, and the things that they do.
You had made sizable donations to EAA before, but now you have presented EAA with a challenge grant specifically aimed at chapters. Why have you done this?
Given my observations about the differences in chapters and how some are highly effective and some are not very effective at all, I thought that a challenge grant would, A, cause EAA to raise adequate funds, more money, than simply a direct grant, and B, doing it that way would give me a better handle on how the funds were used, and I'd have some feedback on whether there was any benefit.
How would you like to see chapters function in the future in EAA?
Chapters are at once EAA's most important, probably biggest asset. At the same time, it's also a potential liability. There are, strangely enough, a lot of people who belong to chapters but don't belong to EAA. And there are a lot of people who belong to EAA who don't belong to chapters. And there would be benefits to both from everybody being involved in a chapter and the parent organization. And so that's a goal I'd like to see addressed. The next thing is the differences in chapters. As I said, 1095 is extremely well run. I was most impressed with the way they go about analyzing their business and how they run the chapter. There's a line of succession. They have regular meetings with minutes and a report to the members. They have a highly successful fly-in. I'd like to see some of those things carried over to other chapters in the organization.
How can people participate in this particular challenge grant, either through money or through efforts?
One of the purposes of the challenge grant is to raise enough money to make a difference. In talking with the Alyssa Lyons, we concluded there may be as much as $500,000 need. And I obviously can't afford to do that. So I thought if EAA was challenged to produce more funds as a result of my grant, that we'd get closer to that. And second, the funds would be used to address some of the concerns and opportunities that I just discussed. One of the things that I suggested, and I'm not trying to run the thing for EAA, but one of the things I suggested is that perhaps it might be a good idea to study the differences between chapters and identify some of the things that make a chapter successful. And in talking to people who have been at or attended the chapter leaders' training sessions, my impression from their impressions is that it is aimed mostly at membership development, and not at some of the other organizational deficiencies that I perceive exist in chapters. Perhaps the additional funds can be used to address ways of improving chapter management, chapters' effectiveness in meeting members' needs, and at the same time maintaining the ability to have different responses to different local conditions.
Mr. Berger, thanks very much.
You're entirely welcome.
You're listening to EAA Radio.